Howdy and welcome to the show. Cooper's Code focuses on legal issues and notable practitioners, distilling wisdom so we all achieve the best result for our clients. If you're enjoying what we do here at Cooper's Code, please help us extend our reach by giving us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts and consider sharing an episode with a friend. What's a lien and why do we care?
The million-dollar question, what is a lien? A lien is basically some other health insurance's interest in your case. For example, the health insurance may say, we paid X amount benefits for your client who was injured by the defendant, and we should be able to recover X amount because it was the defendant's fault. In other words, they have a right in some percentage of the recovery.
Where does this right come from?
It comes from the concept of subrogation. Not to get too far in the weeds, I kind of just think of it as like they have the right to step in the shoes of the plaintiff to recover any kind of benefit they provided. So if they paid, you know, $10,000 because someone injured another person, they're going to use the doctrine of subrogation to try to recover that money. Basically stepping in the shoes of the clients because they paid, they had some skin in the game, something like that.
The phrase I sometimes use with our clients when I'm trying to explain it is that a contract that they never read that stands for either their HMO or their PPO has rules in place that now say because somebody else hurt them instead of them being hurting themselves, and they're getting money from that person who hurt them, and that money is in part for medical expenses, the health insurance now has a subrogation right or a lien claim.
Right. And that contract's based off of that subrogation concept.
I want to ask you, how many classes have been offered at your law school in management?
Well, heading in the middle of my last semester of law school, I've had zero classes on management. I guess the closest thing is being on the moot court team and working with the team and trying to figure out who does what for this competition. That's the closest thing to any type of people management.
And the reason I highlight that is because I think all of us lawyers who have been through law school have recognized one thing, and that is you go to law school and they teach you a lot of law, but a lot of us become small business operators, or we run trial teams, or we run sections in a firm, and none of us get business or management experience. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is there are a lot of shops out there where things are a little bit chaotic. I know that I've had to learn my management skills through trial by fire more than anything else.
I agree. Yep. I've been in a few of those firms as well.
There are entire management consulting industries, schools, and library sections devoted to the issue. So here in a short podcast designed for consumer lawyers and consumer law firms, I would consider this a primer on where to look and what to develop to increase one's success with people within a firm.
Whatever it is that the expert is opining about, as an attorney, I think you have to have a deep understanding of what it is. Your job is to be, you know, a mini expert. Work with your own expert to learn what it is that they're an expert, you know, if it's a medical condition or, you know, whatever, you know, biomechanical issue or, you know, whatever it is. You're not going to know it as well as the expert because you're not an expert, but you can get pretty close. And with that information, as you're questioning the expert, either one, when you're looking at the file, and two, when you're questioning the expert, that's when you can sort of get a sense of, wait a second, what they're saying doesn't make sense. Again, that's where, you know, on the fly, you get a sense of, this person, not making it up, but, you know, this is where they've crossed the line.
And you raise a good point, almost like the elephant in the room. Speaking to your expert, asking the expert, what questions do you want answered to make sure that your own expert has all the information they need from that deposition in order to be prepared for trial and understanding what the other side's opinions are. When you're preparing your case, say at the point that you're thinking of filing the complaint, do you ever look at the jury instructions as a kind of a roadmap to the elements of the things that you're going to want to plead, as well as the facts that you're going to want to discover, so that you are able to develop those tribal issues of material fact? And before I finish my long-winded question, we should probably talk about that. Ultimately, what do you need to be able to beat summary judgment?
you need to be able to establish a tribal issue of material fact. And so a material fact is one of the facts that you need to establish, one of the elements of the cause of action. And there needs to be a tribal issue. The other side has to demonstrate an absence of a tribal issue, which they're going to try and do by foreclosing any question and discovery on the issue or through expert, depending on what the topic is, expert testimony, like in a medical malpractice breach standard of care or lack of breach standard of care. That's going to be expert issue. But oftentimes it's just straight factual issue. So it is really looking at what are the necessary material facts I need to establish this cause of action. And on the other side, how can the other side establish an absence of one of those material facts?
How does a company go through the process of trying to figure out core values?
It's been several years now, but I believe we did it with an initial list of possible values. We went through and highlighted the ones that were most important to us as individuals, then took that list, merged our lists, and prioritized those to come up with our top 10 or so values.
This initial step is pretty easy. You can just Google values and you will instantly find lists of values that you can run through and do exactly the exercise that you're talking about.
But then there was quite a lot of debate related to what should be the core values. I believe we were supposed to choose 5 to 7 core values, and to have everybody get on the same page was somewhat of a challenge at the time that we initially did that.
Well, and in that regard, I think we need to define a little bit who are the people who are in the room. For a solo lawyer, somebody who just works by themselves, doing this exercise can be as simple as pulling up a list and doing it by themselves. If you're not a solo, then what's the group that gets pulled together? What leadership group is one looking at in order to do this exercise for core values?
Since the time of developing our core values, we've built out quite a large leadership team. But at the time that we initially did it, it was just the partners at the firm.
I guess what I'm fishing for, whoever is in leadership at the time, whether that is if it's all partners and the partners are the decision makers, or if there are other people who join the partners in leadership decisions, that's the group that gets together to debate values.
It's a good question, because at some level, a very large leadership team might have more of a challenge. So at this stage with our leadership team of 8, I might reevaluate who needs to be part of that process, but it makes sense to include the whole leadership team if that works.
One of the things that one hears about is some of the impact that wrong people can have overall. It's not just that they're not happy, it's that they can actually have negative impact on the people who work with them if you tolerate their presence, with clients who engage with them, with people, whether it's opposing counsel, judges, mediators, vendors. Wrong people send the wrong message if you tolerate them. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, and that can have devastating impacts on morale within the firm.
I was listening to another podcast recently, Danny Meyer of Shake Shack fame, founder, restaurateur, put this well. He said, the culture you have in your organization is the sum of all the wanted behaviors that you celebrate, minus all of the unwanted behaviors that you tolerate. And I find that interesting because having been at various firms over the years, change is hard. It's hard to recognize that someone who you care about deeply and like spending time with on the most part may not be the right person.
And that's been difficult for us over the past decades. I think we're getting better about it now. It continues to be challenging. But what I like to focus on is the fact that most of these transitions due to folks who are not right people for our firm end up making everybody happier in the long run, all involved.
Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
We have had some people transition out of our firm because they were not aligned with our core values. I think it became clear that they were not aligned and they went on to other opportunities that ultimately, I think, make them happier and are potentially quite a bit better for their careers because they found their sweet spots.
The learning that I would take away and have taken away from the avalanche approach is that experts should be questioned. Don't just rely on it as, oh, well, you know, they're the expert. It must be safe. And where I put that is in the firm, I oftentimes am the trial lawyer who is going out on a case. And I have learned a lot and I know a lot. And I also know that there's a ton that I don't know. And it's important from my perspective for people on the team to all have that willingness to step forward and say, something doesn't feel right. Trust your gut instinct, and everyone has the ability and is encouraged to step forward and say, have you considered this? This issue, everyone seems to be glossing over whatever it is, but this bothers me, and I think that we should spend some time and attention on it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It also makes me wonder, at Coopers, what is the process by which people are educated that they have the authority to question you? So is that something that is discussed regularly, or is this an assumption that everyone should speak up? How do you cultivate that in employees?
One, I think it's important to raise, because the dialogue in my head does not come out of my lips as often as I think it should. And the broader answer to that question is, when we're getting ready for trial, we start typically 6 months out doing trial readiness meetings, where everyone who's going to be part of that trial team is there to chip in and have a conversation about where we are, what things we need to line up. And in those, it's very democratic. It's not a top-down piece. We do try and have an owner of every meeting. Meetings tend to go smoother when there is someone who is in charge of the meeting and the agenda, and we have a list that we go through. At the same time, we encourage anyone to chime in.
My understanding of the Jedi mythos or Jedi philosophy is that it's like sort of a mashup of various strands of Buddhism, Taoism, maybe even Christianity or medieval chivalry or Zoroastrianism, and where one begins and the other ends, I don't know, but I think it's an interesting lens through which to look at not only how we live our lives, how we do our jobs, but how we think about some of the larger issues of life and death and the universe.
I remember some of the references that George Lucas made to Joseph Campbell and the power of myth and the hero with 1,000 faces as inspirations for the storyline and concept. And those always stuck with me. In the approach that you use for your practice, how do you feel about change when it occurs in a case?
Well, change is manifest in a lot of different ways. And when I was looking at your outline and thinking about change, the thing that came to mind for me is changes in the staffing of a case, which are maybe the thing that is most anxiety producing to me historically in my practice, and especially having worked at a larger plaintiff's firm, when we may have paralegals or associates who are pulled in several different directions, and we are all sort of fighting for associate time or paralegal time or consultant time. The changes in staffing are something that I've had to navigate a lot in my practice. How to bring people into a case, how to get them up to speed, how to accept the fact that a staff member is leaving the team to be assigned to a case that has more pressing needs. And that's primarily how I thought about change when I saw your outline. And I don't know necessarily what the Jedi way of expressing or dealing with that is, other than that change as a simplistic truism, but change is a constant and we have to sort of roll with the punches in a non-attached, non-grasping way, to use the Buddhist catchphrase, I guess.
What is your approach to objections in discovery?
In one regard, you need to make objections that you need to make. In another regard, there are going to be questions where you can make an objection. However, this information is going to come out. or this information is clearly relevant and the objection is just a formality or you're doing it to add lip service to the objection. I find that making unnecessary objections gives you less credibility with the opposing counsel, as well as it probably makes the document look a little bloated. It just seems like it's unnecessary work. Sometimes, again, you can make an objection, but this information is going to come out. This is the onset of discovery. If something is unfavorable, I have the tendency to believe that it's better to get some unfavorable fact out in front and start dealing with it on day one versus trying to hide the ball or not disclose it, hide behind an objection, only for it to come out later on when you really kind of deep down in your gut knew it was going to come out.
That makes a lot of sense. I will add from the trial perspective that one of the issues plaintiff's lawyers have is they step into the courtroom with the least amount of credibility of anyone there. The jurors have been preconditioned through decades of advertising by insurance companies to think that we are slick, lying, cheating people who are just out there to get money. And one of the ways that we try to approach that is by making sure that we are not hiding the ball, that we are direct, that we answer questions, and that we provide the information. And when a discovery response gets read with four paragraphs of objections before there is an answer, that has a tendency to undermine the efforts to do that. Let's say you're preparing the husband for deposition, and the husband says, look, I'm concerned that this may come out in terms of, you know, whether I've been followed or what have you. I need you not to tell my spouse I've been having an affair. How do you handle that?
That's a conflict. And at what point in time you have to abide by your ethical duties and make sure that you're handling the situation correctly. I can't be keeping things from people who are on the same cause of action that I represent at the same time like that. I can't keep it quiet all the time. And at which point in time, if this becomes a conflict, now I'm going to have to get another lawyer involved and I'm going to have to excuse myself from representing both sides.
And I think one of the things that we frequently see, and we'll see it in either a knowing waiver of conflict, meaning a written document that people sign when they're agreeing to be engaged by one lawyer for multiple people, is they'll describe what's known as a potential conflict of interest versus an actual conflict of interest.
Correct.
And you just outlined, I think, a potential conflict is if a husband and wife have the same lawyer for the claim and the loss of consortium claim, there's always the potential if a fissure arises between the husband and wife, it becomes an actual conflict when there's an actual fissure where they're getting divorced or they're having some form of dispute. And is it at that point that they have to get another lawyer?
Yes.
Are you familiar with the golden rule?
The golden rule of treat others how you would like to be treated?
That was the one I was fishing for. Although there is another one in the trial world. Are you familiar with that one?
I am not.
In the trial world, you are not allowed to ask a juror, what would you give if this happened to you? You can come close to that line. You can dance around it. But there are many cases that have come down to say just exactly where you can and can't do that. The golden rule, though, in terms of treating others the way you want to be treated is the way I wanted to go down that path. I'm guessing this is something that, given what you described in your household, was a value that was taught to you.
It was, yes.
And how do you employ that when you are engaging with the other side?
To give a little bit of context, it was very hard for me to get to where I am. As a student, schooling wasn't my strong point. And becoming a lawyer was a struggle. And as a working attorney in the profession, I want to raise that profession. I want to make sure that it is respected because you are put into a higher spot in society because you're supposed to represent people's interests and help them and defend them and protect them. And so when I'm interacting with other attorneys, I want to give off that feeling that we need to elevate ourselves. Treat others with dignity, respect, civility, and try to promote that, especially in society right now, which I largely feel is not going in that direction. And if we really want to be leaders, we need to do that. And so I try to employ that, be respectful, have frank, honest, good conversations with other attorneys and build those relationships.
Let's talk a little bit about the history behind why the Code of Civil Procedure Section 999 came about. And to do that, I want to set the stage. There are insurance companies out there. There are lawyers who represent claimants out there. Some of the lawyers who represent claimants were doing what insurance companies refer to as gotcha demands. They were issuing a demand letter saying, pay us the policy. They would send it out on a Friday afternoon. I'm giving an extreme example. Friday afternoon. And the demand would be, unless you have a check in my office on Monday, the time period to accept this has lapsed. And then they'd turn around and they'd say that the insurance company had behaved in bad faith. And they'd try and pursue a open policy through bad faith litigation for the insurance company's failure to accept that very short duration demand. That's the background for how this law came about. It was negotiated between the consumer attorneys and from the insurance companies to try and come up with something where the insurance companies didn't feel like they were receiving these gotcha demands that then turned into bad faith. One of the things that I find I'm frequently having a conversation, since a lot of our clients are cyclists, meaning bicycle, one thing that most people don't know is what role uninsured or underinsured auto coverage plays in that world. Do you have this experience?
Yes. Most of the time, people do not realize that if they do have auto insurance, even though they're on their bike, they could have underinsured motorist or UIM coverage that they can access, even if they're riding on the bike and they were hit by a car. Generally speaking, if you're touched by a car and your injuries flow from that contact, your own uninsurance comes into play.
And so that's when we're sitting down with clients at the beginning and saying, hey, while we don't know how much insurance the other side might have, let's start talking about what might cover you in a worst case scenario. So whether they're driving a car or a passenger in somebody else's car or a pedestrian crossing the street, they've been struck, or a cyclist and they've been struck, we then start saying, okay, do you personally have auto insurance?
Yeah. On the cyclist client, you often get the response, I was riding a bike. What does it matter?
1 in 3 drivers in California have what is known as the California minimum, which is just bare bones, barely enough insurance to cover even an emergency room visit, or they're driving without insurance entirely. And so that means that 1 in 3 incidents that we see, the only thing that's going to be there really to cover you is this underinsured motorist coverage, so long as you have an auto policy. So that's why I have a non-owner operator policy, so that I'm covered if I get hit by somebody else out there when I'm riding to work or I'm out riding with the kids. How do you handle the what is my case worth question? Because most people, when they ask a question, they want an answer.
Definitely. I've definitely had that scenario that you just brought up where a client says, I talked to another attorney and they told me my case was worth $1 million. So I like to talk to them about how I determine the rough value of a case. Rough because we don't know what is going to happen in a case. I like to educate them on the parts of the case that I use to determine what a case is worth. Okay, so I want to first look at, is the other side, the people or companies that we're going to sue, are they liable? How solid is the evidence that we have right now that, for example, the driver did something wrong? And this can get really complicated in terms of who it is we're suing and how easy it will be to find that person or entity. And then when you're talking about a dollar figure, we definitely always are looking at the damages amount. And then a third category that I do like to educate the clients on is collectability. If a person who is experiencing homelessness injures you, it may be hard for us to determine a way to get money from that person. And all of those aspects go into our determination of the case. And then the client can see what we're doing. It doesn't mean that there still is no solid answer. It's the tools that we use and the client can also use to determine what's going on with their case.
What I'm hearing is you educate on that tripod, liability, damages, collectability, and those are some of the tools that you use to evaluate where a case may be headed in terms of value.
Right.
In our role, most of the time, our objections are going to be related to our clients and perhaps treating doctors and experts. But generally, they're people who we can have an opportunity to work with before we get to deposition. And one of my feelings on objections is the best way to be great at objections is to have the right client or witness session before the deposition to make sure that you know what information is going to come out. And I'll share, I will tell my clients typically, I don't object much. And the reason I don't object much is because we've gone over what we're going to go over. If they're completely out of line, I am going to object and I'm going to instruct you not to answer. If you're getting an objection and it's not an instruction not to answer, if I'm telling you vague and ambiguous or some other thing, you're still going to answer that question. But it's a telegraph to you that, hey, look, I don't understand that question. You might need to think about it.
Yeah. Sometimes I think that can help a client in deposition. You're not leading. You're not telling the client what to say, but a client can get nervous sometimes and you can sense that. And let's say a question is vague, but you know, otherwise you would think somebody could probably answer that. If you got a particular client who you're sensing is just nervous about the whole process and scared, and I'll object and say it's vague, and then like I would with any client, you know, go ahead and answer if you can. And sometimes a client is looking for support. And so maybe they'll see that and go, okay, I don't just have to scramble and try to figure out an answer. Like we talked about in depo prep, you know, I'll ask the person questioning me to ask it a different way or something.
What types of styles have you seen and what types of styles do you consider when trying to pick the right mediator for a case?
So one would be their methodology. I pretty much would only select a mediator who I would say is committed to doing whatever they can to bridge the gap between the parties. I like to use mediators who will either call you before the mediation to see what's going on or welcome that call. I also love the mediators who will read the whole brief and the exhibits and be very familiar with what's going on. And the ones who are committed to continuing on after mediation's over to do whatever they can to help.
The mediator who mediates for the case as opposed to the mediator who mediates for the day.
Correct.
As we talk about style, I also think style can sometimes include personality. What personality considerations do you have when selecting a mediator for a case?
Some of it's like a judge, temperament and their personality. Unfortunately, I've had experiences where the mediator doesn't realize how they're coming off to our client, a little aggressive, condescending, not listening. And so if I have one of those experiences, I would not use them.
You raise a good point. There are lots of people who seem to be getting into mediation, and some of them are great, but not all of them bring the same set of skills. And given that there are so many mediators out there, it gives us an opportunity to really pick the right one for a case. As you're going forward with that potential client, now client, how do you work on reinforcing that understanding of mediation in advance of the mediation itself?
Good lawyers will have regular communication with their client, at least periodically check in, even when there's nothing particularly active going on in the case. And so during those check-ins, you gently remind what the trajectory is, what the timeline is first. After we sign you up, we do some investigation, written discovery, then there's depositions. There may be an opportunity to do a settlement demand or mediation. If that doesn't go well, maybe there's a motion for summary judgment. And then we get towards trial if we haven't resolved at that point.
to young people out there thinking about being a lawyer, I will tell you it's a good life. The question is, if you want to be a trial lawyer, do you like competition? It can be any kind of competition, not just sports or something, but any kind of competition. Do you think that you could live with the fact that you might try a case and lose it? Because people do lose. So that's where the competition comes in. But here's the bottom line. If I ever saw a country, my country, your country, that needs reform in all areas, including the law, it is us now. In fact, I've said this to a couple of people. If I could, I would start all over. And I would work on diversity, which is not put the Supreme Court to one side, is not accomplished at this point the way it ought to be. And I would work on all these things again with the vigor of a young person. And so the law is a tool for that.
Let's fast forward to the mediation day. And let's presume that despite your best efforts, the mediation is not ripe, that it becomes clear that it's not going to go anywhere. What do you do with that day in order to make it as productive as possible?
I like to check in with the mediator to use their experience and also their special knowledge by being able to be in both rooms as to what might be the best next step. Sometimes it might be a mediator's proposal. Sometimes it might be scheduling another session. Sometimes it might be just the mediator following up between both sides. There are also times where the counsel on both sides feel comfortable enough closing the gap because we've gotten far enough along that we can do it ourselves. And then there are other options too, like 998. There are a lot of different ways you can approach it depending on what's going on at that point.
As an end user going through the experience of doing concept focus groups at the beginning of a case, one of the takeaways, and where I'm probably an evangelist for the work that you do, whether with you or anyone else, the idea of doing this early in the case and the learnings that come from it. I think of cases where we would not have tailored the discovery in the same way as we did because of things that were brought up by the focus group participants. Why does that matter? And the other piece that I will share with you, in a direct exam of an expert, if you run out of questions, the thing is always, what's the significance of that? Having sat through countless focus groups with you, I feel that your mantra is, whenever there is a question posed, was he wearing a helmet? Your response is, well, why do you want to know that? And that's a question. Why is that the go-to question for you when you're doing the concept focus groups?
Why do I want to know that?
Yes.
Well, first of all, thank you for your evangelism. And it's always gratifying for me to hear that the work I'm doing is helping. I mean, really, I can never get enough of that. It just makes me feel so much better inside to know that there's a practical application that is assisting my clients who are trying to help people who have suffered some wrong from someone else. I mean, that's why I keep doing this. This is part of the difference between survey and focus group. You know, the survey can tell you what people think, but understanding the why behind it is what helps you put together the story, right? So do they want to know, was he wearing a helmet or not, right? And I think we're thinking about the same case probably. Sometimes there are different conclusions people can draw from the answer to that question. And without knowing what's motivating the question and how that factors into the equation, sometimes the answer is, they'll tell you, well, I was just curious. It doesn't, but sometimes it is a marker for them of the care that your client takes or had taken on the worksite, or it's a marker for them of the care that the employer or the tortfeasor has taken with something. To understand why are they interested in that piece of information helps me, at least, to understand how we put the pieces of the puzzle together. And also the order in which we tell the story, right? So if you can say that so-and-so went to work that morning, got in his truck, drove out to the field, got out, set up. He had his harness on. He had his helmet on. He had these tools with him. And boom, here's what happened when something fell and hit him on the head, right? Just being able to include that as part of the story answers questions for jurors, and in this case, irrelevant as a matter of law, right? But it answers a question for jurors to help them understand the scene and the setting and attribute positive valence to the actions of our plaintiff. So that's why we want to know why. That's always my question, is to make sure I understand how they're fitting the pieces together.
I think it's important to bring forward that anytime we're talking with a potential client, having the conversation about the importance of underinsured motorists, even if they're not in a serious incident, that particularly on the cycling side, carrying high underinsured motorist is important because, quite honestly, it's the cheapest disability insurance that you can buy.
Yeah, so one of my roles at the firm has been handling client intake calls in the past. And in handling those calls, something I would notice is a lot of cyclists end up injured and they do not have an auto insurance policy. That makes sense. They're cyclists. Sometimes that is their way of getting around, especially maybe in San Francisco. You see a lot of people that they only use the bike to travel around the city and they don't have a car. And so they don't have an auto insurance policy, which means they do not have UIM coverage. In the state of California, it's about 1/3 of drivers are either driving without insurance or the state minimum $15,000 of insurance. So we get a lot of calls from cyclists who, as I said, may not have an auto insurance policy. But we're looking at this situation where you got a roughly 30 to 40% chance of being hit by somebody with only $15,000 in coverage, which if you're struck on a bicycle, a lot of times $15,000 is not going to be enough coverage for you.
Whether it is an insurance adjuster, a judge, a research attorney, opposing counsel, whoever is receiving the material that is being provided typically is not there because they're interested in picking up your material because it's their version of Hemingway. More succinctly, they may go home and read something for pleasure at the end of the day. It's not the stuff that you're providing. So how do you go about making that information as simple as possible and as interesting as possible to be able to hopefully get the attention from the decision maker who is reviewing the draft of the material that you write and then the attorney approves in terms of it going out the door?
I would say I definitely adopt a more Hemingway style. When I first started in this field, I would say that I had a decent amount of experience writing. But I had not written in this type of industry. You know, I had not written demand packages. I had not written for personal injury law. You know, I was writing history papers or research papers, very different type of writing. But something that was drilled into my head from the very beginning is cut out those extra words, those embellishments. You don't need to say that, you know, the pain was super bad. The pain was just bad. What does adding super do to it? That might be a bad example, but there are instances where people just tack on a little word that, sure, it carries some weight, but ultimately it just takes time to read and it does not actually provide any additional information to the adjuster or the attorney or the judge. It's not useful at all. And so if you keep those words out, and that's kind of been my goal as I write, if I keep out any unnecessary words in it, it kind of just fact, fact, fact. Each sentence should just be kind of a fact and oftentimes points to some sort of evidence backing up that fact. It sounds super simple, but just keep everything to the facts.
Can you walk me through, as if I was, say, your case manager, that session that you had with a case manager to help prepare that person for you not being available?
I think it was more than one session. I make myself available for an hour for each person on the team every week. So maybe like a month out, we start talking about what needs to happen and what to expect with me gone. another big category, which I should have mentioned, was who's going to fill in for my absence, like what I do for them. So getting that organized in the background as well. And then just making sure that everyone's comfortable as best as they can be before I leave with their caseload, with the intakes coming in with our intake manager, just making sure everyone's prepped and feels like, you know, this is going to be successful.
With this being your first jury trial, did you have concerns about handling opening, having not seen an opening in a jury trial before?
I did. I would be lying if I said I wasn't nervous, but like most things, I am more nervous before it begins. But going into it, I knew that I had done everything to prepare. I had gone through it so many times in the hours that night that I wasn't sleeping. I was going through it in my mind. And to be honest, as soon as the jury came in, I can tell by the looks on their faces that they were intrigued and they were listening. And it kind of just came natural. And I was surprised on how natural it felt, actually.
Why is it cost effective for a case to resolve in pre-litigation as opposed to going into the complaint being filed and full litigation going forward?
It's cost effective in the sense that once you file a lawsuit, the case costs are going to go up significantly, increase significantly. Mainly, the costs are fairly low in pre-litigation. You may have your cost to obtain records, the occasional, maybe you need an expert report or something like that. But other than that, you know, there's no filing fee. You're not retaining a handful of experts trying to prove different parts of the case. So in that sense, it could make more sense for the client to resolve the case in pre-litigation instead of going, you know, all the way to trial or close to trial, that sort of thing. The other thing is time-wise as well. What we try to do is get the case into a position to settle or to figure out if it needs to go into litigation around a year. We try to get that figured out.
For those who are evaluating a decision to go to law school, whether it's straight out of college or 15 years down the line, what would you tell them in terms of your decision to go? Was it the right decision and why?
For me, I think it was the right decision. It wasn't like a no-brainer. Obviously, it took me 15 years to decide to actually pull the trigger on it. But for me, it was like 2011. I wasn't 100% sure I wanted to become a lawyer. I think I was in my early 30s then. I was like, well, maybe I'll have another career path or something. I took the LSATs and I don't know if I could pull the trigger. I don't want to take more student loan debt in. I'm not 100% sure I want to take this route. So fast forward another 7 years. I got married in 2018 and on the honeymoon, I started talking to my wife and just like, you know, I feel like I've kind of hit the ceiling here with my position. Like a paralegal. I've done it for, at that point in time, it had been 10 years already and probably in Paris or something after a night out. I decided that, hey, I'm going to talk to the partners at the firm about, you know, next steps. We didn't really pull the trigger on whether I would go to law school or not. I just like, I need to find out what the vision is here. And when I got back, I talked to one of the partners and I was like, I kind of feel like I want to be able to go in like a managing position or something like that. And he said, maybe you should think about going to law school because I don't have that vision of being that big of a firm at that point in time. That idea of going back to law school clicked in my mind. And I talked to you, Marianne, about it. And you guys all thought it was a really good idea, which gave me the confidence that I could do it. I mean, and I'm coming from, my dad didn't go to high school.
Wow.
I mean, my mom never went to college. So there wasn't like, oh, you know, Uncle Jack did that, you know, or I didn't have like the professional kind of pedigree, I guess. You really don't know, like, is that possible for me to do this? I don't know. I mean, I did good in school and stuff like that, but I guess I never had like the big dream that you could do something like that. But after talking to you guys, I felt comfortable with it. My wife was totally on board, wanted me to do it. And we talked about like what kind of sacrifice it's going to take. I was going to do night school and work the whole time, which would have been 4 years. It took 4 years to do that and basically pulled the triggers. I ended up having to take the LSATs again because my scores had expired and applied and ended up going. Fast forward, four more years and then ended up taking the bar.
The other piece, when I talk about sweating in training versus bleeding in combat, I had my own panic moment in a courtroom when we went to play a video depo and there was no sound. And the previous depo had played just fine on the same system with the same speaker and everything else. And I had the good fortune of having that same paralegal who was the musician. He happened to be in the gallery that day. He was watching a little bit of it. And as I'm fiddling with this, he comes up. And apparently, on occasion, a video depo operator will record something in mono instead of stereo. And because it was recorded in mono, and because we had two outlets for the speaker, only one was plugged in, he said, switch them. So I switched. It was the right and the left. So it didn't matter which one it was. I just switched the cable that was plugged into the speaker from the one that wasn't plugged into the one that was plugged in. Problem solved. These are little learnings that I've actually had that happen about four times now in trial where it has been recorded the wrong way. And just that switch takes you from no sound to having sound. Those are the little pieces where a trial tech firm or a little bit of experience of it not going the right way will teach you how to have things work out.
In that situation, I would be sitting there for forever trying to figure out what the issue was. So yeah, those little learnings, they really help.
And the prickly feeling of sweat that just roars up your back when something is not going right in court. The amazing thing that comes with that is you will never forget that lesson. One of the things that we build into our processes are checklists so that while it may be something that we are in essence on autopilot, when you serve a complaint, you also want to make sure you serve the summons and you want to make sure that you serve the statement of damages and you want all these little things that become so routine that you're not likely to forget them. But the best way to not forget them is to make sure that you check every step along the way.
Absolutely.
And the benefit of that is very few dropped balls when there are checklists and processes, and they improve the efficiency side of things. And I think that's where we're going to be spending a lot of our conversation today, on the efficiency side and where one can start tightening those timelines so that at the end of the day, we want to make sure that a case that could be done in a year doesn't take 4 years.
Right. That's one of the important things about processes, or what I find most useful about some of our processes are the ones that kind of do give that direction on timeline. We have processes that are kind of more, I don't want to say general, but this is how you would complete such a task. But we also have other processes that say, this is what you're trying to do, and here is the exact timeline that we like to get it done by. By X days after being served this, we want to have completed this project. That has been a huge help in actually keeping people on track and making sure we're meeting these goals that we have as a firm.
One of the things that becomes important is making sure that you fill the airtime, that there's always somebody there during the time that one is presenting evidence. So how did you work with folks, the team, in terms of making sure that we had the contact information for the people who were coming, they knew where they were coming so that they were on time, parking was explained to them, juror lines or security was explained to them, and we had the schedule kind of slotted out to make sure that people knew where they were going.
Right. So I was personally at the trial every single day, but we actually had a lot of the witness coordination going on from another paralegal who was not there, but it was through just constant communication and keeping up to date on what's going on inside the courtroom. And honestly, having the person not there, I think is kind of helpful because they can make the phone calls, make the emails all day long. I can send a little message from inside the courthouse saying, hey, we might need somebody this afternoon because we're a little bit ahead of schedule. Can you see what you can do? Fortunately, in this trial, we did pretty well on timing the whole way. And part of it was we had a lot of treating doctors who we could not coordinate their in-person testimony.
Let's be clear. They flat out said, hell no, we're not going to show up for your trial via Zoom. Play our depositions.
That is correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any thought, wisdom, knowledge that you'd want to pass on to people who are listening?
Well, I think the thing is, it's nothing is ever hopeless. I lost one case between 1986 and now, one jury case. I lost a couple on appeal where I got punitive damages tossed back down my throat. But many of those cases that I tried were cases I didn't want to try. The thing about a plaintiff's attorney is you settle the cases you'd like to try, and you try the case you'd like to settle. I guess that's what I would say. I've been in a situation where when I learned, this was early in the game, before 86, I remember getting my one and only a migraine headache because I learned I had to try the case, and the guy that gave me the case, who told me I had an expert, was lying to me. But I now represented the plaintiff, and I had to try that case to a jury. And it was a horrible feeling, but yet I learned from it. Not only did I learn from it, I grew from it. You grow from any case you come in contact with. You grow from any association you have with juries because they're just people. And you'll see from that, you'll learn some of the things about, you know, how you spot potential defense juror and how you, mannerisms and what have you. It's hard to explain, but you get the feeling for it. And take the risk, take the chance, try the case. Don't let your ego get in the way of being a hero, because it's so comfortable sometimes just to take the money and run. And maybe you go to Hawaii, you take the settlement, but you know it's not right. You know you could do better. Well, do better. And that experience of taking the risk will make you a far better lawyer and make you able to win case after case after a while. There'll be a long string of victories. And when it does happen, when you lose, which you inevitably do, you'll just feel bad. That's the one you'll remember more than anything else, is the one you lost.
It might be nice to hear from you kind of some of the strategies that were employed in terms of identifying punitive damages where some others might not have necessarily turned them into punitive damages, and how those were able to be used in the case to be able to get the best result for the client.
Yes, I would say start thinking about it early in the case. You may not have the information at the time that you're putting a complaint together. And it really depends on the type of case. If it's a product, you can always go on to the United States Consumer Protection and do like a FOIA request to try to get that information. But you're not always going to have that early on in a case. So start thinking about it in discovery. And in discovery, if it's like a auto accident that involves a driver of a semi-truck, there will always be usually another piece to the traffic collision report where they come in and do a further examination of the truck company, the driver, and then you can start looking into past crashes, things of that nature. You're looking for a pattern of behavior that takes it out of negligence, but more to a reckless disregard for safety. So kind of be keeping it in your mind early on as you're doing discovery and building your case.
Do you have a preference about whether in-person versus remote when it comes to an MSC?
We've been doing a lot of remote. I always think in person is better. Seeing the whites of the eyes, seeing people in person, meeting the other side briefly if they want to, having the other side meet your client, because sometimes they're a file number or however they index their cases, they're a claim number. But it makes a difference when you realize it's a real person on the other side and they see that person. So I prefer in person, but a lot of the times, especially carriers are out of state, so they will be appearing by Zoom. So it seems like most of the time we're kind of in a hybrid situation.
And the other piece that I've found very interesting is there are some counties where absolutely we're back in person, we're doing everything face to face. That is our preference. And others have gone into it's more efficient for us to do it this way. We're going to be defaulting to Zoom. In fact, we'd prefer if you called your witnesses during trial by Zoom. The whole process has been interesting.
It is. And you're right. It's totally county by county. I mean, sometimes we initially will get a notice from the court and it will say that we're in Zoom and we've planned for that. And then we find out shortly beforehand, we're actually supposed to be there in person because the judge we've been assigned to prefers that. So, you know, be prepared for last minute changes and prepare your client for last minute changes.
How do you initially start going about that practice in terms of making sure that the person's actually going to show up and that the person is ready to be there and not, say, cause a mistrial or some other issue in the case.
So I like to contact the witness, but then stay in contact with them often. Let them know, yes, the case is still going. Let them know when we expect that we will need them. Let them know the logistics, time, date. Let them know it's likely we will not need them on the first day, but that we need to get their availability for the next week or two afterwards, and we will do the best to accommodate their schedule. But stay in contact with them early and prepare with them early.
I understand as lawyers, we have the subpoena power. Don't you just issue a subpoena and the witness willingly says, oh, I understand the power of the court. I'm totally willing to show up. Does that not happen?
No. And I would not go to that step right out of the gate. No one likes to have a process server come up to their door and hand them a legal paper that is ordering them to be somewhere. You don't want them to be coming in as a hostile witness. So I would reach out to them, be friendly, be courteous, let them know that we don't want to inconvenience them with having a process server show up at, you know, all hours. See if they will be willing to accept the subpoena by email and just acknowledge receipt of it. But you do want to have a subpoena, even if it is a friendly witness. Because if they're on the stand and they're asked about it, we don't want to make it seem like they're our witness. We want them to be able to say, yes, I know this person, I'm friends with this person, or I work with this person, but I'm also here because I received a subpoena to be here for trial. You know, most of them will be appreciative that you're trying to be accommodating, but always send a subpoena.
It's a different time now. We're, I think, closer to 50% in terms of the numbers of women and men who go to law school. And from my perspective, I've seen change. I know from being married to a woman who is a lawyer.
A very good lawyer, I might add.
Yes. That whether there has been change, there has not been enough change. And with your experience, seeing the changes over the years, do you have any views about how the progress that has been made and the progress that remains?
Well, I think there has to be a greater tolerance for a wider band of styles, less judgment about limiting women to certain styles, even speech patterns. I think that's still something that we need to work on and do deeper listening.
If there are young women in the law right now who are listening to this, do you have any recommendations to them in terms of your personal experience and how you were able to carve your path?
Well, again, I think that you need to have your friends, men and women, to help you have that sense of community and stability and reality as you feel your way through. So if you're a law student, pay attention who's sitting to your left and sitting to your right, because they may become your best friend and your colleague that you will rely on in the future. You're making your future now in the present. So that's the main message.
And coming at it from a different direction, for men, those of us who want to be allies in the profession, do you have any feedback on how one can best serve as an ally? You mentioned the well-intentioned folks, and I know that there are a lot of us men who want to help and in doing so start mansplaining about how here's the best way to do it.
Right. Or I think you're trying to say. Yes. Right.
Yes.
I know the help. Look, you have women that in your life that you have great respect for. I know that.
Yeah.
And so to use them to help you as you do a hard examination of how you communicate when you stop listening. I think it's always an interesting exercise to say to a man, when do you stop listening to a woman? I stop listening to a woman when? And also to have women say, I stop listening to men when? And it's a very interesting conversation. I highly recommend it for your next dinner party.
That may go on at dinner tonight at the house. I've never thought of it that way. That's fascinating.
And then it's step back and then listen. What did I miss?
While most people may have some concept, what is workers' compensation?
We hear them talk in code AOE, COE, and that's, does the injury arise out of employment or in the course of employment? That's the number one thing that they're looking for. I'm not an applicant's attorney, but I've learned some of the lingo over the years. And if the injury did happen AOE, COE, then they have a workers' compensation case.
From the perspective of workers' compensation, does workers' comp cover, say, non-economic damages, damages to the human being versus economic damages?
Yeah, so there are some major differences between a workers' compensation case and the civil case. One is workers' compensation is a no-fault system, and that reflects a compromise from when the system was originally developed. As we know in our practice, we're contingency fee-based. We have the burden of proof to establish fault and total damages. But in the workers' compensation system, as long as you prove that the injury arose out of and in the course and scope of employment, it doesn't matter who's at fault. And so likewise, what it means is there is a compromise that you can't just get everything. And so the damages are limited to medical care relating to the injury and some disability benefits, which is basically a partial replacement of the lost earnings. Now, on the civil side, you have a lot more damages opened up. There's loss of household services, and the big one is general damages. And if your client has a spouse, the spouse can claim loss of consortium. I also want to note that in the workers' compensation side, even though they can claim the lost earnings and the medical treatment, it tends to be at a lower amount than you probably get on the civil side.
You talked about looking at a jury, not as individuals, but as a composite. And I'd love to hear your explanation for folks as to why you do that and how you do that.
Well, why I do it is because they have to come to a collective decision. I think that's very important. I think to know where they live, what kind of work they do, have a sense of how much they earn, what their political leanings are, all of the things that everybody looks at is important. But once you've digested all of that, including age, gender, and where they come from, very important, you have to look at, are they going to be able to work together? Boy, it's hard to say, look, here's a recipe or here's a formula and do it. I just kind of take a look and say, well, this guy looks like he's going to be a leader, or this woman looks like she's going to be a leader. What kind of a leader is she going to be? Because there's the leader that's strident and says, this is what I think, and tries to shove everybody in a direction. And sometimes that'll work. But if you have other thinking, quote, thoughtful people on the jury, how is that leader going to interact? Is that a person that is going to bring out other people, ask for their opinions, have some kind of organized way of looking at how they're going to do the processing when they get in the jury room? And so I'll ask questions in voir dire, you know, you in your job at your work, do you work with a group of people? And how do you work with a group of people? And what do you think about, is it important to you, whether, you know, your way or the highway? Some people feel that, you know, if you know something, you know it, and other people should just accept it. And I try to find that out. And then I look at who else I've got, and I say, what's it likely that they're going to be able to work together? So that's what I do.
What does the employer have to do to preserve their rights in terms of recovery? Is there more than a lien that is required as far as that's concerned?
I've seen a lot of times the employer will just serve and file even a notice of lien, and that's fine until the case is settled. They have their option. They must intervene or file their own complaint to seek reimbursement for those benefits they've provided prior to the dismissal of your action, if you're the only one who's filed. Otherwise, they have no right to reimbursement.
CCP 2016-090, any party can make this initial disclosure. And throughout the litigation, a party can propound a supplemental demand twice before the initial setting of a trial date. That's the setting of the trial date, not the trial date itself. And then once after the initial setting of the trial date. So there can be supplemental demands throughout, but unlike the federal rule, correct me if I'm wrong here, there's no ongoing duty to update, to supplement.
So part of what we're trying to work through is, as people adjust to this new significant change in the discovery rules, how do we implement it in a way that's going to be meaningful and get the best results? And one is sending the demand out early to get all the material at the beginning of the case from the other side. And the other is making sure that you do a supplemental demand shortly before trial. So you're using that one after trial setting, but shortly before trial so that you get all of the last dribs and drabs and can kind of foreclose the unexpected of, oh, yes, well, they didn't ask for this. What exactly is a guardian ad litem?
My understanding is when a lawyer represents someone, a party, who the court deems incompetent to represent themselves. There are specific categories of these people. One is a minor, that means a person under 18. Another category is people who do not have the mental capacity to make legal decisions for themselves. And I believe the third category is individuals who are under a conservatorship. So if you represent a person in one of these categories, that person is not competent under the law to make legal decisions. And so they need a stand-in. And a guardian ad litem in a lawsuit in which, you know, one of these three categories of persons is a party, the court takes extra care to make sure that these people are not being taken advantage of, to make sure that the party's best interests are being put forward.
Today's goal, as we kind of go through things, is to talk a little bit about what happens when one has done a beautiful discovery plan, sent out all the discovery, and one does not get much in the way of information back. Are there tools that you have used to try and get the information other ways so that when the defense extends the middle discovery finger, you find that you found it in some other fashion?
Before filing the case, I'm, you know, Googling them, looking them up, seeing if there's any articles or anything on my issue. Depending on the case, if it's maybe a premises liability case, I'm looking on Google Street View to see how an area has changed over time. I like to use the Internet Archive Wayback Machine to see, you know, what representations are on the company's website, or even just Googling, for example, if it's a products case, how to use this product. Most companies have a website that show you what the proper use is and how the product is supposed to function.
And I'll add to that, a lot of companies now are posting information about their products on YouTube.
Right, exactly. I had that recently, and I showed it at a PMK depot, and the PMK said, "That's not true, what was on the video." And I said, "Well, why would they put this on the video if it is not true?" So you might get some interesting information there.
It's always wonderful when the PMK says that something that their own company has posted is not correct.
Yeah.
It's time to start directing the defendant to mediation on that one.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Are there things, as you look on your practice now, that you would want younger lawyers who are listening to this to absorb? What wisdom would you share with them?
First, I would say that it's important to go to a firm that tries cases. And sometimes that's not a civil litigation firm. Sometimes that's a DA's office or a PD's office. I think if you want to be a trial lawyer, you have to be in the right setting to meet your goals. If you get into that setting, I think it's important when you're communicating with your client to do so in a way that doesn't always suggest you want to get rid of the case. And I know that sounds simple, but the carriers and the clients are always looking at, well, what will this cost to try the case? How much is your time going to be? And if we lose, so they're always looking at kind of the bottom line. And I think it's really important for young lawyers to evaluate cases in a way that'll allow them to get to trial. And we do that. If you could settle a case for $750, but you think it's only worth $350, then tell them it's worth $350. And don't say, hey, it could go worse. And waffling on the value. And things change. And, you know, as you get closer to trial, usually the case gets more valuable if you're a defense lawyer. And especially the value stays low if it's somebody else's file. But if it's yours,
the value goes up in your head as you get closer to trial. So you have to position yourself to try a case by communicating confidently what the value is without waffling.
Thank you for listening today. Please email us at podcast@cubers.law with questions and comments. Like what you heard, share us with a colleague and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. To all of you doing justice out there, happy hunting.